stations, the radio hookup, and the rush would pass, and he would be back once more in his workshop, in his procedures trainer. No, the one thing he had experienced all morning that was not second nature was his aching bladder. That had become the first terra incognita. Please, dear Lord, don't let me fuck up. Shepard waited for another stop in the countdown. This time it was to wait for some clouds to pass over the launch area. And he announced his problem over the closed radio circuit. He said he wanted to relieve his bladder. Finally, they told him to go ahead and do it in the suit. And he did. Because his seat or couch was angled back slightly, the flood headed north toward his head, carrying consternation with it. The flood set off a suit thermometer, and the Freon flow jumped from 30 to 45. On swept the flood until it hit his left lower chest sensor, which was being used to record his electrocardiogram, and it knocked that sensor out partially, and the doctors were nonplussed. The news of the flood rushed through the worlds of the life science specialist and the suit technicians like the destruction of Krakatoa west of Java. There was no stopping it now. The wave rolled on over rubber, wire, rib, flesh, and 10,000 baffled nerve endings, finally pooling in the valley up the middle of Shepard's back. Gradually it cooled, and he could feel a cool lake of urine in the valley. In any case, the discomfort in his bladder was gone, and everything was still. If they had not scratched the flight because of the dam break, he had not fucked up. The next thing the medical team knew, a voice was coming over the closed loop, their private radio link up with the Mercury capsule.
Well, I am a wetback now.
The man was beautiful, imperturbable at every juncture. 15 minutes in the countdown before they fire a 7-story bullet full of liquid oxygen underneath him, and he remains smiling now. The hold had now dragged on for 4 hours, and each engineer monitoring the panels showing the status of the various flight system was agonizing over whether to declare finally that his system was go, after which it would be his responsibility if the system malfunctioned. By now, there was agony on all sides. It was transmitted into the capsule in 1,000 unspoken ways and sometimes in so many words. It was as if Shepard, lying here on his back, inserted, wired, strapped, and screwed into this tiny holster, were the ganglion, the agony junction for 1,000 tense and tortured souls on the gantry outside and on the ground below. Through it all, he had remained smiling out at the Cape. At T-minus 6 minutes before the completion of the sequence that would lead to the launching, there was yet another hold, and one of the doctors came on the closed telephone circuit and said to Shepard, "Are you really ready?" It was hard to figure out whether the question was addressed to the body or to the soul. It wandered into the unmentionable terrain of the most righteous stuff itself, and it was Smiling Al who handled it. He laughed and said, "Go." "Good luck, old friend," said the doctor. "Farewell from the Valley of the Woeful Abyss." At T-minus 2 minutes and 40 seconds, there was another hold. Now Shepard could hear engineers in the blockhouse agonizing over the fuel pressure in the Redstone, which was running high. He could sense what would be coming next. They were going to talk themselves into resetting the pressure valve inside the booster engine manually. That would mean postponing the launch for another 2 days at least. He could see it coming. They were going to scrub the whole thing, lest they hold themselves accountable for his hide if something went wrong. This was not a job for Smiling Al. It was time for the icy commander to arrive and take charge. So he got on the circuit and put the glacial edge on his voice, as only he could do it, and he said, "All right, I'm cooler than you are. Why don't you fix your little problem and light this candle?" "Light the candle," he says. The words of Chuck Yeager himself. The voice of the Rocket Ace. Oddly enough, it seemed to do the trick. Realizing the astronauts' irritation, they began wrapping up the process and declaring their systems go. It was nearly 9:30 a.m. by the time the countdown entered its last minute. Shepard's periscope began automatically retracting inside the capsule, and he remembered that he had put in the gray filter to cut out the sunlight. If he didn't remove it, he wouldn't be able to see any colors in flight. So he started moving his left hand toward the periscope, but his left forearm hit the abort handle. Oh, shit! That was all he needed now. Fortunately, he had barely brushed it. The abort handle was the equivalent of the ejection seat cinch ring in an airplane. If the astronauts sensed some catastrophe that the automatic system had not picked up, he could turn the handle and the escape tower rocket would fire and pull the capsule free of the Redstone and bring it down by parachute. That was all he needed. The world waits for the first American spaceman, and Shepard gives them an exhibition of a little man popping up a few thousand feet in a thimble and floating down by parachute. He could see it all in a flash. Another popped cork fiasco. The hell with changing the filter. He would look at the world in black and white. Who cared? Don't fuck up. That was the main thing. Time seemed to speed up tremendously in the final 30 seconds of the countdown. In 30 seconds, the rocket would ignite right underneath his back. In those last moments, his entire life did not pass before his eyes. He did not have a poignant vision of his mother or his wife or his children. No. He thought about abort procedures and the checklist and about not fucking up. He only half paid attention to Deke Slayton's voice over his headset as he read out the final 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, and the rest of it. The only word that counted here in this little blind stuffed pod was the last word. Then he heard Deke Slayton say it. Fire. You're on your way, Jose. Louise Shepard was not in the valley of the woeful abyss. She was here in her house in Virginia Beach. But beyond that, it was hard to chart the locus of her soul at that moment. Never in the history of flight test had the wife of a pilot been put in any such bizarre position as this. Naturally, all the wives had been aware that there might be some press interest in the reactions of the wife and family of the first astronaut, but Louise hadn't bargained for anything like what was now going on in her front yard. Every now and then, Louise's daughters would peek out the window and the yard looked like the clay flats 3 hours after the Mark's Midway Carnival pulls in. Mobs of reporters and cameramen and other big-timers were out there wearing bush jackets with leather straps, running this way and that and knocking back their Pepsi Colas and knee-highs and yelling to each other and mainly just milling about, crazy with the excitement of being on the scene, bawling for news of the anguished soul of Louise Shepard. They wanted a moan, a tear, some twisted feature, a few inside words from friends, any goddamn thing. They were getting desperate. Give us a sign. Give us anything. Give us the diaper service man. The diaper service man comes down the street with his big plastic bag, smoking a cigar to provide an aromatic screen for his daily task, and they're all over him in his steamy bag. Maybe he knows the Shepherds. Maybe he knows Louise. Maybe he's been in there. Maybe he knows the layout of Shea Shepherd. He locks himself in the front seat, choking on cigar smoke, and they're banging on his panel truck. Let us in! We want to see! They're on their knees. They're slithering in the ooze. They're interviewing the dog, the cat, the rhododendrons. These incredible maniacs were all out there tearing up the lawn and yearning for their pieces of Louise's emotional wreckage. The truth was, however, that Louise Shepard could hardly be said to be experiencing the feelings that all these people were so eager to wolf down. Louise had her chances to become a nervous wreck over owls flying many times, most recently at Pax River. In 1955 and 1956, Owl had tested one hot new fighter plane after another. Their names were a delirium of sharp teeth, cold steel, cosmic warlords, and evil spirits. The Banshee, the Demon, the Tiger Cat, the Skylancer, and so on. And Al took them through not only maximum performance runs, but also high-altitude tests, in-flight refueling tests, and carrier suitability tests. a stolid phrase that covered a multitude of ways for a test pilot to expire. Louise knew the entire world of the test pilot's wife. The calls from other wives saying that something has happened out there. The wait in a little house with small children to see if the friend of widows and orphans is coming to make his duty call. Day after day, she tries to be stoic. She tries not to think about the subject, not to pay attention to the clock when he doesn't return from the flight line on time. Well, my God, what an improvement Project Mercury was over the daily lot of the test pilot's wife. No question about it. The worst part of the Pax River days had been the constant wondering and worrying, alone or with uncomprehending little faces around you. This morning, Louise knew exactly where Al was every minute. He was hard to miss. He was on nationwide television. There he was. She had merely to look at the screen. On nationwide television, they were talking about no one else. You could hear the laconic baritone voice of Shorty Powers, the NASA public affairs officer in the Mercury control room at the Cape, periodically reporting the astronaut's status as the countdown proceeded. Then the telephone rings, and she hears that same voice, calling to speak to her, Louise. Al had spoken to Deke, and Deke had spoken to Shorty, and now Shorty, possessor of the voice that the entire nation was listening to, was talking to her personally, explaining the reasons for the delays as Al had requested. Nor was she alone in this house, hardly. It was getting crowded in here. In addition to the children, there were her parents who had come from Ohio and had been here for days. A few of the other wives had arrived. Al had been stationed nearby in Norfolk when the program began, and so they had many Navy friends and neighbors whom they knew well, and quite a few of them had come by. There was quite a burble of voices building up in the living room. It didn't sound very tense in there, and of course she had merely half the newspapers in America in the front yard, the usual rabble of gawkers who materialized for car wrecks or roof jumps or traffic arguments, and the whole lot would have liked nothing better than to charge in and gather round if she opened the front door to them so much as a crack. Life had wanted to have two writers and a photographer on the premises to record her reactions from start to finish, but she had held out against that. So they were waiting in a hotel on the beach, and it was agreed they could come inside as soon as the flight was completed. Louise hadn't even had all that much opportunity to sit in front of the television set and let the tension build. She had gotten up before dawn in the dark to fix breakfast for everybody who was staying in the house, and then there was the whole business of fixing coffee and whatnot for the other good folks as they arrived, until before she knew it, she was caught up in the same psychology that works at a wake. She was suddenly the central figure in a wake for my husband, in his hour of danger, however, rather than his hour of death. The secret of the wake for the dead was that it put the widow on stage, whether she liked it or not. In the very moment in which, if left alone, she might be crushed by grief, she was suddenly thrust into the role of hostess and star of the show. It's free. It's open house. Anybody can come on in and gawk. Of course, the widow can still turn on the waterworks, but it takes more nerve to do that in front of a great gawking mob than it does to be the brave little lady serving the coffee and the cakes. For someone as dignified and strong as Louise Shepherd, there was no question as to how it was going to come out. As hostess and main character in this scene, what else was there for the pilot's wife to do but set about pulling everybody together? The press, the ravenous but genteel beast out there upon the lawn, did not know it, but he was covering not the anguished wife at liftoff, but the honorable Mrs. Commander Astronaut at home, in the first wake, not for the dead, but for the gravely endangered. Louise didn't even have time to collapse in neurasthenic paralysis over the possible fate of her husband. It was all that the star and hostess could do to get back to the TV room in time for the final minutes of the countdown to watch the flames roaring out of the Redstone's nozzles. With all the world wondering about the state of her soul at this moment, what kind of face should she have on? Over his headset, Shepard heard Deke Slayton from inside the Mercury Control Center, as it was called, saying, "We have liftoff." And as he had done hundreds of times on the centrifuge and on the procedures trainer, he reached up and turned on the onboard clock, which would tell him when to do this and that on his flight schedule. And he said over his microphone, "Roger, liftoff, and the clock is started," as he had said hundreds of times on the centrifuge and the procedures trainer. Then, with the automatic anticipation of someone who had heard the same phonograph record over and over again and is now hearing it yet once again and senses every chord and phrase before it sounds, he waited for the gradual buildup of the G-forces and for the beating noise as the rocket lifted off, which he had felt and which he had heard hundreds of times on the centrifuge. Hundreds of times. Even if he had been ordered at that point to broadcast to the American people a detailed description of precisely what it felt like to be the first American riding a rocket into space, and even if he had the leisure to do it, he could not possibly have expressed what he was feeling. For he was introducing the era of pre-created experience. His launching was an utterly novel event in American history, and yet he could feel none of its novelty. He could not feel the awesome power of the rocket beneath him, as the broadcasters kept referring to it. He could only compare it to the hundreds of rides he had taken on the centrifuge at Johnsville. The memory of all those rides was embedded in his nervous system. Scores of times he has sat in the gondola on the wheel as he sat here now in his pressure suit with the Mercury instrument panel in front of him and the noise of a Redstone launch piped into his headset. And compared to that, what was happening at this moment was not awesome. Quite the opposite. He was braced for it, but it didn't throw you around like the centrifuge. The centrifugal force of the centrifuge threw you around inside the capsule as well as increasing the speed of the G-forces. The rocket was smoother and easier. It wasn't as noisy as the centrifuge. On the wheel, the recorded sound of the Redstone rocket was piped directly into the capsule. But now, since he was the figurine in the packing box, it came from outside, through layer after layer. By the time it penetrated the escape tower cover and the capsule wall and the contoured seat behind his head and the helmet and his headset, it was no louder than the engine noises a commercial airline pilot hears on takeoff. In fact, he was far more conscious of the noises inside the capsule. The camera. There was a camera set up to record his facial expressions and eye and hand movements. He could hear that whirring about a foot from his head. There was a tape recorder set up to record all the sounds inside the capsule, and he could hear its little motor running, and the fans and the gyros and inverters. It was like an extremely compact modern kitchen in here, with all the gadgets running at once, and of course, the radio. He thought he would have to turn the volume up to maximum, as he had on the centrifuge, but he didn't have to touch it. All he had to do was talk into his voice mic and say the exact same things he had said 1,000 times on the procedures trainer. Altitude 1,000, 1.9 Gs, and so on. And they would answer back, "Roger, we copy, you're looking good." And it even sounded the same way over the headset. He could still see nothing. The periscope was still retracted. He had no way to judge his speed except by the needle on the instrument panel that showed his rising altitude and the buildup of the G-forces on his body. But this was gradual. It was a very familiar feeling. He had felt it hundreds of times on the centrifuge. It was much easier than pulling 4 Gs in a supersonic aircraft, because he didn't have to struggle to push his hands forward against the weight of the G-forces to control the trajectory of the aircraft. He didn't have to lift a finger if he didn't want to. The computers guided the rocket automatically by swiveling the nozzles. He had very little feeling of motion, just the G-forces driving him deeper and deeper into the seat he was lying on. The rocket rose so gradually it took 45 seconds to reach Mach 1. An F-104 fighter plane could have done it faster. When the rocket reached transonic speed, 0.8 Mach, a vibration started building up, just as it had for the X series of rocket planes at Edwards years before. Shepard was quite prepared for it. He had been through it on the centrifuge so many times, but it was a different vibration. It didn't shake his head about as violently, but the amplitudes were more rapid. His vision began to blur. He couldn't read the instrument panel any longer. He started to report the phenomenon over his headset, but thought better of it. Some bastard would panic and abort the mission. Christ, the vibrations, no matter how bad, were preferable to an abort. Within another 30 seconds, all the vibrations were gone, and he knew he was going supersonic. With the vibrations gone, he once again had no sensation of motion. He was still blind to the world outside. He was still lying on his back, looking at the instrument panel, no more than 18 inches from his eyes, in the greenish light of the capsule. The G-forces reached 6 times the force of gravity, then began to tail off as the rocket and the capsule approached the weightless phase of the arc of flight. It was different from the centrifuge. It was easier. On the centrifuge, the only way to reduce the G-load as you simulate the approach to the weightless phase was to reduce the speed of the centrifuge arm. And this always threw you forward against your straps. When the simulated moment of zero G arrived, you were thrown up against the straps quite hard. On a rocket ride, however, as all the rocket pilots at Edwards knew, your speed did not abruptly decrease as the rocket ran out of fuel. It kept sailing. Shepard was eased into weightlessness so smoothly it was as if the weight of the G-forces had simply slid off his body. Now he could feel his heart pounding. The most critical part of the flight, next to the launch itself, was only a moment away. The separation of the capsule from the rocket. He heard a muffled explosion from above, just the way it sounded in the simulations. And the escape rocket blew off, and the capsule was now free of the rocket. The force of the rocket pulling away accelerated his speed, and he felt as if he had a kick from below. A 3-inch-long rectangular light lit up green on the instrument panel. On it were the letters J-E-T-T, Jet Tower, for Jettison Tower. With the tower gone, the periscope would start operating, and he could look out. But he had his eyes pinned on the green light. It was beautiful. It meant everything was going perfectly. He could forget about the abort handle now. The launch phase was over. The most treacherous part of the entire ride was now behind him. All that endless training in the procedures trainer, abort, 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 he could put that behind him and forget about it. Small portholes were on either side above his head, and he could see only the sky through them. He was now slightly more than 100 miles up. The sky was almost navy blue. It was not the much talked of blackness of space. It was the same dark blue sky that pilots begin to see at 40,000 feet. It looked no different. The capsule was now automatically turning so that its blunt end, the end beneath his back, which had a heat shield for re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere, was aimed toward the target area. He was facing back toward Florida, toward the Cape. He could not see the Earth out of the high portholes at all, however. He wasn't even particularly interested in looking. He kept his eyes pinned on the instrument panel. The gauges told him he was weightless. After reaching this point so many times on the procedures trainer, he knew he must be weightless. But he felt nothing. He was so tightly strapped and stuffed into this little human holster that there was no way he could float as he had in the cargo bays of the big C-131s. He didn't even experience the tumbling sensation he felt when riding backseat in the F-100s at Edwards. It was all milder, easier. No doubt he should say something to the ground about the sensation of weightlessness. It was the great unknown in spaceflight. But he didn't feel anything at all. He noticed a washer floating in front of his eye. The washer must have been left in there by a workman. It was just floating there in front of his left eye. That was the only evidence his 5 senses had to show that he was weightless. He tried to grab the washer with his left hand with his glove, but he missed it. It floated away, and he couldn't move his hand far enough to get it. He had no sensation of speed at all, even though he knew he was going Mach 7, or about 5,180 miles an hour. There was nothing to judge speed by. There were no vibrations at all in the capsule. Since he was now completely beyond the Earth's atmosphere and was no longer attached to the rocket, there was no rushing sound whatsoever. It was as if he were standing still, parked in the sky. The sound of the interior of the capsule, the rising and falling and whirring and moaning of the inverters and the gyros, the cameras, the fans, the busy little kitchen, they were exactly the same sounds he had heard over and over in the simulations inside the capsule on the ground at the Cape. The same little kitchen in operation, whirring and buzzing and humming along. There was nothing new going on. He knew he was in space, but there was no way to tell it. He looked out the periscope, the only way he had of looking at the Earth, the goddamn gray filter. He couldn't see any colors at all. He had never changed the filter. The first American to ever fly this high above the Earth, and it was a black and white movie. Nevertheless, I want to know about it.
What a beautiful view, he said. He could hear Slayton say, I bet it is.
In fact, there was a cloud cover over the East Coast and much of the ocean. He was able to see the Cape. He could see the West Coast of Florida, Lake Okeechobee. He was up so high he seemed to be moving away from Florida ever so slowly. And the inverters moaned up and the gyros moaned down and the fans whirred and the cameras hummed. He tried to find Cuba. Was that Cuba or wasn't that Cuba? Over there, through the clouds. Everything was black and white and there were clouds all over. There's Bimini Island and the shoals around Bimini. He could see that. But everything looked so small. It had all been bigger and clearer in the Alpha Trainer when they flashed the still photos on the screen. The real thing didn't measure up. It was not realistic. He couldn't see anything but a medium gray ocean and light gray beaches and dark gray vegetation. There were the Bahamas, Grand Bahama Island, Abaco Island, or were they? The pale gray cloud cover and the medium gray water and the pale gray beaches and the medium gray, the grays ran together like goulash. He didn't have time to fool with it. He had a long checklist. He was supposed to try out the roll, yaw, and pitch controls. They were all operating automatically up to now. He switched over to manual one at a time and tried using the hand controller. Okay, he said into his microphone, switching to manual pitch. And the capsule nosed up and down. Pitch is okay, he said, switching to manual yaw. All this he seemed to have said 100,000 times before in the procedures trainer, and the capsule yawed from side to side. He had felt it 1,000 times before on the Alpha Trainer. Only the sound was different. Every time he turned the manual control handles, hydrogen peroxide jets discharged outside the capsule. He knew it was happening because the capsule would pitch, roll, yaw, just as it was supposed to. But he couldn't hear the jets. On the Alpha Trainer, he had always been able to hear the jets. The real thing was not merely so realistic as that. The capsule pitched and yawed just like the Alpha, no difference, but he couldn't hear the jets at all because of the humming, moaning, and whining of the inverters and gyros and fans, the busy little kitchen. What? Before he knew it, the ride was practically over. It was time to prepare himself for re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere. He was descending the arc, just like a mortar shell on the way down. The ground was starting the countdown for the firing of the retro rockets that would slow the capsule down for re-entry through the atmosphere. There was no need for them on this flight because the capsule was going to come back down in any event like a cannonball. But they would be essential in orbital flights, and this flight was supposed to test the system. The retro rockets fired automatically. He didn't have to move a finger. There was another muffled rocket firing, not a loud noise at all. The little kitchen kept humming and whining away. He was riding backwards, still facing Florida. The rocket firing drove him backward into the seat with a force of about 5 G's. It was much more sudden than the transition from 6 G's to 0 G on the way up. Man, that wasn't like the centrifuge. The centrifuge jerked you around at this point. In the next instant, he was weightless again. And he knew he would be. The retro fire was like pumping the brakes once, but it had slowed down the capsule, and soon the G-forces would start building up. They would build up gradually, however. He knew the interval exactly. At this point, an explosive device was supposed to go off and jettison the rigs that held the retro rockets. He heard the little dull explosions outside the capsule, and then he saw one of the straps of the rig go by his window. He could feel the twist from the torque of the retro rocket nozzles, but it corrected itself automatically. Now he was supposed to practice controlling the attitude of the capsule while it was slowing down, so he swung it this way and that way, like a Ferris wheel seat. Oh, shit. The dial showed the G-forces were building up slightly. 1/2 G. This meant he had about 45 seconds to check out the stars. He was supposed to look at the stars and the horizon and see if he could fix on particular constellations. Eventually, this would have some bearing on space navigation, but mainly there would be millions down there wanting to know that the first American in space had been up there in the neighborhood of the stars. Oh, they would all want to know how the stars looked from outside the Earth's atmosphere. They weren't supposed to twinkle when you looked at them from up here. They would just be little shining balls in the blackness of space. Except that it wasn't black. It was blue. The stars, man! He kept staring out the windows, trying to make out the stars. He couldn't see a damn thing, not one goddamn star. If the capsule were pitched up this way or rolled over that way, he would get zaps of sunlight in his face. If he pitched it or rolled it this way, he still couldn't see a damn thing. The light in the interior of the capsule was too bright. All he could make out was the navy blue sky. He couldn't even see the horizon. There were supposed to be spectacular color bands at the horizon when viewed from above the atmosphere, but he couldn't see them out of the portholes. He could see them through the periscope, but the periscope was a black-and-white movie. What in the name of... The G-forces were building up too fast. This wasn't the way it happened on the centrifuge. The G-forces were coming up so fast, driving him back so deep into his seat, he knew he couldn't complete the maneuvers he was supposed to make on the fly-by-wire system. Whether he did them or not on this flight would make no difference as far as his own safety was concerned. This was practice for orbital flights. In orbital flights, the one thing the astronaut would be able to do would be to hold the capsule at the proper attitude, the proper angles, if the automatic system malfunctioned. Nevertheless, he was behind on the checklist. Falling behind put you in the threshold of fucking up. Soon he wouldn't be able to control the capsule's attitude with the manual controls or the fly-by-wire. The G-forces would be too severe for him to use his arms. So he switched back to automatic, forgetting to shut off one of the manual buttons when he did so. He was behind on the checklist. The simulation had crossed him up. He was supposed to have more time than this. He was in no danger whatsoever, but how could real life vary this much from the simulation? Looking for those motherless stars and color bands had thrown him off, eaten up time. But even so, the buildup of the G-forces came smoothly. The capsule began to swing from side to side as it came through the denser and denser layers of atmosphere, but it was not nearly as rough a ride as the same interval in the centrifuge. He was lying on his back again. If he looked up, he looked straight toward the sky. He tensed his calves and the muscles of his abdomen to counteract the G-forces just as he had 1,000 times on the centrifuge. He forced his breath out in grunts as the Gs pressed down on his chest. He grunted out the G readings as they rose on the dial. 6, 7, 8, 9. Then he kept repeating, but kept grunting out the word, okay, 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 to let the ground know that the G-forces were on top of him, but that he was all right. He could see nothing except indigo out the portholes. He didn't even bother looking. He kept staring at the instrument panel, at the big lights that would show the parachutes were coming out. They would come out automatically. The first green light came on. The drogue chute. The parachute that pulled the main chute out had deployed. Now Shepard could see it through the periscope. He could see the needle pass 20,000 on his altimeter. Why doesn't it, at 10,000 feet, the main chute came out as he could see through the periscope? Then it filled and the jolt slammed him back into his seat once more, a kick in the butt for reassurance. He knew he had it made. The capsule swayed from side to side under the parachute, but there was nothing to it. He was lying on his back. The landing bag was right underneath his back. He started undoing his knee straps. Get out of all these goddamn straps, hoses, and wires. That was the main thing. He took his face seal hose and oxygen exhaust hoses off his helmet. Through the periscope, he could see he was coming closer and closer to the water. It was sunny out there. He was near Bermuda. The ships were all nearby. He could hear them clearly on the radio. Then the blunt end of the capsule hit the water. It was right under his back. The impact drove him back into his seat yet again. It was just like they said it would be. It was about the same jolt you get when you land on the deck of an aircraft carrier. No more than that. The capsule keeled over to the right. The right-hand window was underwater, but he could look out the other one and see his yellow dye marker on the surface of the water. It was released automatically. It made a big yellow stain so that the rescue helicopters could spot the capsule better. Shepard was busy trying to get himself out of the rest of the rig, get free. He broke the neck ring seal off his helmet so that he could get the helmet off. He kept looking at the window that was underwater. The capsule was supposed to right itself. The goddamn window stayed underwater, gurgling. He kept looking all around for signs of water seeping in. He couldn't see any, but he could hear it. It had finally started seeping in on the ape's flight. The goddamn capsule was not made for the water. What a way to blow the whole thing this would be. Bobbing around in the goddamn water in a bucket. The capsule slowly came up vertical. The helicopter was already overhead, radioing for instructions. He had made it as long as he didn't fuck it up getting out of the capsule. He opened the door at the top of the capsule, the neck, with a cable device and pulled himself up. A tremendous burst of sunlight hit him, sunlight on the open sea. It was barely 10:15 in the morning. He was 40 miles from Bermuda on a sunny day out in the Atlantic. The noise of the helicopter overhead obliterated every other sound. The crewmen were lowering a rescue sling, which looked like an old-fashioned horse collar, the kind they used to put on dray horses. It was a big helicopter, an industrial type. It had already hooked onto the capsule and pulled it up out of the water. There were Marine Corps crewmen inside the helicopter. The noise was overwhelming. They kept staring at him and smiling. It was that glistening look. It took only 7 minutes to reach the helicopter's mothership, the aircraft carrier Lake Champlain. The capsule swayed back and forth below the helicopter. It was very sunny. It was a perfect day in May out near Bermuda. The helicopter began descending to the flight deck of the carrier. Shepard looked down, and he could see hundreds of faces. They were all looking up toward the helicopter. The entire crew of the ship seemed to be on the deck. Their faces were all turned up toward him in the sunlight. Hundreds of faces turned up in the sun. They covered the whole aft section of the deck. They were massed in between the moored airplanes. They were all looking up toward the helicopter and moving, surging toward the spot where the helicopter would come down. He could make out a whole force of masters at arms down there, trying to hold them back behind the ropes. As the helicopter came close to the deck, he could see the faces more clearly. And they had that look. Hundreds of faces already had that glistening look. Chapter 11. The Unscrewable Pooch. Glenn and the others now watched from the sidelines as Al Shepard was hoisted out of their midst and installed as a national hero on the order of a Lindbergh. That was the way it looked. As soon as his technical debriefings had been completed, Shepard was flown straight from Grand Bahama Island to Washington. The next day, the six also-rans joined him there. They stood by as President Kennedy gave Al the Distinguished Service Medal in a ceremony in the Rose Garden of the White House. Then they followed in his wake as Al sat up on the back of an open limousine, waving to the crowds along Constitution Avenue. Tens of thousands of people had turned out to watch the motorcade, even though it had been arranged with barely 24 hours' notice. They were screaming to Al, reaching out, crying, awash with awe and gratitude. It took the motorcade half an hour to travel the 1 mile from the White House to the Capitol. Al sometimes seemed to have transistors in his solar plexus, but not now. Now, he seemed truly moved. They adored him. He was on the Pope's balcony, 30 minutes of it. The next day, New York City gave Al a ticker tape parade up Broadway. There was Al on the back ledge of the limousine with all that paper snow and confetti coming down just the way you used to see it in the movie tone news in the theaters. Al's hometown, Derry, New Hampshire, which was not more than a village, gave Al a parade, and it drew the biggest crowd the state had ever seen. Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force, and National Guard troops from all over New England marched down Main Street, and acrobatic teams of jet fighters flew overhead. The politicians thought New Hampshire was entering Metro Heaven and came close to renaming Derry Spacetown USA before they got hold of themselves. In the town of Deerfield, Illinois, a new school was named for Al overnight, just like that. Then Al started getting tons of greeting cards in the mail, cards saying congratulations to Alan Shepard, our first man in space. That was already printed on the cards, along with NASA's address. All the buyers had to do was sign them and mail them. The card companies were cranking these things out. Al was that much of a hero. Next to Gagarin's orbital flight, Shepard's little mortar lob to Bermuda with its mere 5 minutes of weightlessness was no great accomplishment. But that didn't matter. The flight had unfolded like a drama, the first drama of single combat in American history. Shepard had been the tiny underdog, sitting on top of an American rocket, and our rockets always blow up, challenging the omnipotent Soviet integral. The fact that the entire thing had been televised, starting a good 2 hours before the liftoff, had generated the most feverish suspense. And then he had gone through with it. He let them light the fuse. He hadn't resigned. He hadn't even panicked. He handled himself perfectly. He was as great a daredevil as Lindbergh, and he was pure. He did it all for his country. He was a man with the right stuff. No one spoke the phrase, but every man could feel the rays from that righteous aura and that primal force, the power of physical courage and manly honor. Even Shorty Powers became famous. The voice of Mercury Control, he was called. That and the eighth astronaut. Powers was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, a one-time bomber pilot, and all during Shepard's flight, he had come on the air from the flight control center at the Cape saying, "This is Mercury Control," and reporting the astronaut's progress with a baritone coolness of the combat pilot's righteous art, and people loved it. After the capsule splashed down, Powers had quoted, or seemed to have quoted, Shepard as saying everything was A-OK. In fact, this was a Shorty Powers paraphrase borrowed from NASA engineers who used to say it during radio transmission tests because the sharper sound of A cut through the static better than O. Nevertheless, A-OK became shorthand for Shepard's triumph over the odds and for astronaut coolness under stress. And Shorty Powers was looked up to as the medium who communicated across the gulf between ordinary people and star voyagers with the right stuff. Bob Gilruth's status rose sharply, too. After a solid year of flack and grief, Gilruth had finally earned the eminence of riding in one of the limousines in Shepard's triumphal motorcade through Washington. James E. Webb was sitting next to him, and they were looking out at the thousands of people who were smiling and crying and waving and cheering and taking pictures. "If it hadn't worked," said Webb, "they'd be asking for your head." As it was, Gilruth and Mercury and NASA were, all at once, names that stood for American technological competence. Our boys no longer botch it, and our rockets don't blow up. None of this was lost on the president. His opinion of NASA had now swung around 180 degrees. Webb was aware of that. 3 weeks before, after Gagarin's flight, when Kennedy had summoned Webb and Dryden to the White House, the president had been in a funk. He was convinced that the entire world was judging the United States and his leadership in terms of the space race with the Soviets. He was muttering, "If somebody can tell me how to catch up, let's find somebody. Anybody. There's nothing more important," he kept saying. "We've got to catch up." Catching up became an obsession. Finally, Dryden told him that it looked hopeless to try to catch up with the mighty integral and anything that involved flights in Earth orbit. The one possibility was to start a program that put a man on the moon within the next 10 years. It would require a crash effort on the scale of the Manhattan Project of the Second World War, and would cost anywhere from $20 to $40 billion. Kennedy found the figure appalling. Less than a week later, of course, the Bay of Pigs debacle had occurred, and now his new frontier looked more like a retreat on all fronts. Shepard's successful flight was the first hopeful note Kennedy had enjoyed since then. For the first time, he had some confidence in NASA, and the tremendous public response to Shepard as the patriotic daredevil challenging the Soviets in the heavens gave Kennedy an inspiration. One morning, Kennedy asked Dryden, Webb, and Gilruth to come to the White House. They sat down in the Oval Office, and Kennedy said, "All over the world, we're judged by how well we do it in space. Therefore, we've got to be first. That's all there is to it." After this build-up, Gilruth figured Kennedy was going to tell them to cut the Redstone suborbital flight short and move straight to the series of orbital flights using the Atlas rocket. They were still considering 6 and possibly 10 more suborbital flights, like Shepard's, using the Redstone rocket. Gilruth had thought of moving straight to the orbital flights, although it was a daring proposition, given the problems they had been having on tests of the Mercury Atlas system. So they were absolutely startled when Kennedy said, "I want you to start on the moon program. I'm going to ask Congress for the money. I'm going to tell them you're going to put a man on the moon by 1970. On May 25th, 20 days after Shepard's flight, Kennedy appeared before Congress to deliver a message on urgent national needs. This was, in fact, the beginning of his political comeback from the Bay of Pigs disaster. It was as if he were starting his administration over and delivering a new inaugural address. "Now is the time to take longer strides," he said. "Time for a great new American enterprise. Time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth." He said that the Russians, thanks to their large rocket engines, would continue to dominate the competition for some time, but that this should only make the United States step up its efforts. "For while we cannot guarantee that we shall one day be first, we can guarantee that any failure to make this effort will make us last. We take an additional risk by making it in full view of the world. But as shown by the feat of astronaut Shepard, this very risk enhances our stature when we are successful." Then he said, "I believe this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish." Congress was not about to quibble over expenses. NASA was given a $1.7 billion budget for the next year, and that was merely the start. It was made clear that NASA could have practically as much as it wanted. Shepard's flight had made quite a hit. An amazing period of budgetless financing began. It was astonishing. Suddenly, money was in the air. Businessmen of all sorts were trying to bestow it directly upon Shepard. Within a few months, Leo D'Orsay, who was still the boy's unpaid business manager, had counted up $500,000 worth of proposals from companies who wanted Shepard to endorse products. One congressman, Frank Boykin of Alabama, wanted the government to give Shepard a house. Shepard turned it all down, but it did make one stop and think. If Smiling Al's experience was any indication, then this astronaut business was becoming even more of a fighter jock heaven than it had been in the first year of Project Mercury. Eisenhower had never paid much attention to the astronauts personally. He had looked upon them as military volunteers for an experiment, and that was that. But Kennedy now made them an integral part of his administration and included them in its social as well as its official life. The other fellows had gone along for Al's trip to the White House, but the wives had remained at the Cape. When they flew back down to Patrick, the wives were out of the field to meet their plane. And they all had a single question. What's Jackie like? Jackie Kennedy's exotic face and sixth-floor designer collection clothes were in every magazine. They all had a curious sensation. In one corner of their souls, they were still junior-level military officers and wives who saw people like Jackie Kennedy only on the pages of magazines and newspapers. And at the same time, they were beginning to realize that they were part of the strange world where those people, the people who do things and run things, actually exist. What's Jackie like? Soon enough, they would all meet her. They would go to the private lunches at the White House where there were so many servants, there seemed to be one behind every chair. They played you like man-to-man basketball. Jack Kennedy was very warm toward the fellows. He courted them. That glistening look would come over his face from time to time. The business of manly honor cut through everything at last, and even the president would become merely another odd male in the presence of the right stuff. As for Jackie, she had a certain southern smile, which she had perhaps picked up at Foxcroft School in Virginia, and her quiet voice, which came through her teeth as revealed by the smile. She barely moved her lower jaw when she talked. The words seemed to slip between her teeth like exceedingly small, slippery pearls. Her excitement, if any, over the prospect of lunch with seven pilots and their frows may not have been great, but she couldn't have been kinder or more attentive. At one point, she invited Renee Carpenter back for a private visit, and they talked like any two friends about all sorts of things, including the problems of raising children in the modern age. One had only to think of any other seven pilots' wives in a squadron. All of a sudden, the Honorable Mrs. Astronaut existed on a plateau upon the upper reaches of American protocol, where the perquisites included Jackie Kennedy. As for the fellows, it was pure heaven. None of this altered the Edwards-style perfection of their lives. It merely added something new and marvelous to the ineffable contrast of this astronaut business. Within hours after lunch at the White House or water skiing in Hyannisport, you could be back at the Cape, back drinking and driving in that marvelous low-rent rat shack terrain, back in your Corvette, spinning out on the shoulders of those hardtack Baptist roadways and pulling into the all-night diner for a little coffee to stabilize the system for the proficiency runs ahead. And if you had switched to your Banlon shirts and your go-to-hell pants, they might not even recognize you in there. Which would be all the better, and you could just sit there and drink coffee and have a couple of cigarettes and listen to the two policemen in the next booth with the Dawn Patrol radio sets in their pockets, and a little voice packed in static would be coming out of the radio saying, 31, 31, man named Virgil Wiley refuses to return to his room at the Rio Banana. And the policemen would look at each other as if to say, well, shit. Is that anything to have to rise up from over a plate of French fries and death balls for? And then they'd sigh and start getting up and buckling on their gun belts, and about the time they would head out the door, in would come the heartiest cracker, the aboriginal grit, an old guy drunk as a monkey and ricocheting off the door frame and sliding in bow-legged over a counter stool and saying to the waitress, how you doing? And she says, so-so, how are you doing? I ain't doing any more. It's dragging in the mud, and it won't come up. And since this doesn't get a rise out of her, he says it again. It's dragging in the mud, and it won't come up. And she just clamps, a burglar-proof look of aloofness across her face. And all this was bound to make you smile. Because here you were, listening to the merry midnight small talk of the hardiest hardtack crackers of the most low-rent stretch of the Cape, and just 12 hours ago, you were leaning across the table in the White House, straining to catch the tiny, shiny pearls of tiny talk from the most famous small talker in the world. And somehow, you belonged and thrived in both worlds. And yes, it was the perfect balance of the legendary Edwards, the fabled Muroc, in the original Chuck Yeager and Pancho Barnes days, now brought forward into the billion-volt, limitless-budget future. The truth was that the fellas had now become the personal symbols not only of America's Cold War struggle with the Soviets, but also of Kennedy's own political comeback. They had become the pioneers of the New Frontier, recycled version. They were the intrepid scouts in Jack Kennedy's race to beat the mighty Integral to the moon. There was no way they could be regarded as ordinary test pilots, much less test subjects, ever again. For Gus Grissom, that was a very fortunate thing. Gus was assigned to the second Mercury Redstone flight scheduled for July. He would be in a newer capsule, one in which certain changes had been made, all of them in response to the astronauts' insistence that the astronaut function more like a pilot. It had been too late to renovate the capsule Shepard used, but Grissom's had a window, not just portholes, and a new set of hand controllers designed to let the astronaut control the capsule's attitude in a manner that was more like an aircraft pilot's, and a hatch with a set of explosive bolts that the astronaut could blow in order to get out of the capsule after the splashdown. Nevertheless, the flight would be a repetition of Shepard's, a suborbital lob 300 miles out into the Atlantic. Gus himself encouraged certain changes in the flight plan. Since he would be taking the next flight, he had sat in on Shepard's debriefing sessions on Grand Bahama Island. Nobody, not even within NASA, was about to criticize Al openly for anything he did, but there was implied criticism of what he did toward the end of the flight, when the G-forces built up faster than he expected them to, and he was desperately staring out of his two portholes trying to find some stars. Some character from the flight systems division kept asking him if he hadn't left a manual control button on after he shifted over to automatic control. This would have wasted hydrogen peroxide, the fuel that operated the attitude control jets. It didn't particularly matter on a 15-minute suborbital flight, but it could have made a difference if it had been an orbital flight. Al kept saying he didn't think he left the button on, but he really couldn't say for sure. And this character kept coming back in and asking the question all over again. This was the first indication that the fellas had about a major truth concerning space flights. You didn't take the capsule off the ground. You didn't bring it up to altitude. You didn't alter its course, and you didn't land it, i.e., you didn't fly it. And so your performance was not going to be rated on how well you flew the craft, as it would be in test flight or combat. You could be rated only on how well you covered the items on your checklist. Therefore, the fewer items you had on your checklist, the better shot you had at a perfect flight. Each flight was so expensive, there would always be people on the ground, engineers, doctors, and scientists, who wanted to load up your checklist with all sorts of things to try, their little experiments. The way you handled this problem was to allow operational items on your list and growl, gruff, and otherwise balk over the rest. Testing the attitude control system was acceptable, because that had operational written all over it. That was like flying an airplane. By the time he took off, Gus's checklist had been pared down to the point where he could concentrate on the new hand controller that had been installed. Gus stayed at the Holiday Inn until practically the day before his flight, maintaining an even strain. He cut down a little on the water skiing, which was his main form of exercise, and on the nocturnal proficiency runs on the highways, in order to avoid getting banged up on the eve of the flight. But otherwise, life went on pretty much as usual at the Cape, here in fighter jock heaven. One night, just before the flight, when he was in the cocktail lounge, evening out the strain a bit, who should Gus run into but Joe Walker? NASA had given Joe a few days off from Edwards to attend the launch, and so here he was. By this time, July 1961, Walker and Bob White had been flying up a storm in the X-15.